Welcome, everyone, to a very special edition of the Percepta Podcast. This is our second Developer Roundtable cast. I am Josh Beiser, who will be acting as moderator for today. For those of you who listened to our first cast, I hope you enjoyed that. And we're basically going with number two. We've got a new guest, new topics, and a new format, which I'll be getting to in a few minutes. But to get things rolling, let's introduce our panelists tonight. So, first, Tanya. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Tanya Short. I'm the captain and designer and producer of Kit Fox Games, which is a four-person studio up in Montreal, Canada. And we're currently working on Moon Hunters, which is a 1-4 player RPG for PC and PlayStation.
Awesome. All right. Jamie, you're up next.
Hi, I'm Jamie Fristrom. I've been making games professionally for over 20 years. I went indie about 10 years ago after working on the Spider-Man games at Treyarch, and I'm sort of bringing my Spider-Man mojo back with a game called Energy Hook right now, which should come out this year for Steam and PlayStation.
Awesome. And last but not least, Alex.
Hi, I'm Alex Bolzer. My husband and I co-founded Robot Loves Kitty. Our latest game that we're working on is called Upsilon Circuit, which is a very strange game that's hard to describe in a short period of time. So there's that.
Awesome. All right. It's great to have the three of you back on the podcast. I'm sure we're going to have a very interesting discussion tonight. So before we get going, for those of you listening, I just want to explain the format changes between the last roundtable and this one. We did these changes just to make it all easier on our guests and to allow us to discuss more topics during the roundtable. So for tonight, we've got a huge set of topics we're going to get to. We're going to spend about 10 minutes per topic before moving on to the next one. And we're going to be going for probably the next hour and a half, about there. And if you like this format or have any questions or comments about these roundtables, please feel free to leave any comments in the podcast section below. All right, so our first topic this evening is going to be the value of exhibiting your games. So this is essentially what you put into getting your game out there in front of people. And this is definitely a very important topic for any indie developer listening. So for the three of you, obviously each of you have had experience with this. So could we go down, I guess, the list here and share, and you can share some of your thoughts about getting your game out there in front of the public's eyes. Let's start with Alex this time.
We've actually had wonderful experiences showing our game. It's difficult because it's hard to know exactly what the value of something like that is, because it's hard to quantify. But the fact that you get to see people playing your game, like actual fans at places like PAX or game developers at places like GDC, and it's the feedback that you get and just the experience of having people enjoy what you do is so rewarding. It's expensive. It's terrifyingly expensive sometimes, especially when you're a really small team, because it's not just, a lot of people feel like, oh yeah, they have this booth. I'm sure it costs money to get that space, but it's never just that. There's hotels, there's travel. And if you're more than just one or two people, it gets really expensive.
And then there's also like the preparation for it.
Oh yeah.
Like it's more than just a play test, right?
There's the preparation for developing the game, because you need to have it in a special state sometimes, even just to let people play it without breaking it or have it not be broken at all, or if you're trying to do something special for PAX. And then there's also like printing things up and getting stuff to hand out for the booth, like swag and things like that. And really, preparation happens months in advance.
Yeah, and I don't think that the average gamer or even the average, I don't know, AAA developer, like, understands how it can really put a drain on the team to lose even just a week to one of these shows. Not to mention the sickness you usually get afterwards. like a whole week being lost, you really do have to look at what you're gaining for sure. Alex, I mean, it seems to me that it's clear your games are really, really great for exhibiting. Do you feel that way?
We try. we feel like one of the rewarding things about the games that we're just interested in is the people interaction. That's one of the things that we're kind of focused on. So they do seem to show pretty well. But I think that it's hard for me to even imagine a game not benefiting from going to a show on some level, but it also always depends on where the game is in development, because it is a financial investment. It is a time investment. And for us, we've definitely multiple times lost weeks and weeks of progress, so to speak. I'm making air quotes, but you can't see them.
Yeah, and I think both of you made really good points about the value of exhibiting your game. Tanya, you said about certain games are better for exhibiting than others. And that is a really strong point. When you look at, you know, a story or a very narrative-driven game, it's very hard, you know, to distill that down into a 20, 30-minute demo, you know, without outright spoiling the game. But if you have something like a strategy game or some procedurally generated game, it's a lot easier to showcase that because you're not, you know, showing your whole hand in the demo in that way.
Well, there's also just some experiences that don't lend themselves to 10, 15-minute, you know, kind of bite-sized experiences, or don't lend themselves to a noisy, crowded area. Like I've seen, so when we showed it at PAX Prime last year, one team went so far as to build this, like, tent to try to block out all of the sights and the sounds and the smells of PAX. And that was great, but it was still a bit of a weird feeling going into this little tent and like trying to forget that you're in a crowded space and trying to really put your mind into a place where you can get scared by something or get really, really emotionally involved in something. And I mean, I imagine, like Alex says, it's still worth it for them. Like, I'm sure that they felt like it was worth it, but they had to work a lot harder to make the experience something that players could understand, I think, what it would be like to play in their own house.
Yeah.
Even then, I've seen very, very complex games kind of not have a great time exhibiting because a player sits down, and by the time they even are getting, like, you know, a quarter through the tutorial, they've kind of lost interest and wander away. Like, I feel like people's attention spans are much lower.
Yeah. And the cost, I think, is another good point. As you just said, Tanya, to set up, like, a massive booth to, you know, drown out everything around you, or to set up, like, a specific situation, there's, of course, the cost of developing of that on top of, you know, bringing your game, taking the week off, and, you know, the pre-show preparation. And all these are costs and factors that can go into, you know, what would be maybe 20, 30 minutes per consumer who comes into your booth.
Yeah. And I mean, the cost of, I went to a talk at, I think it was GDC last year, by Juicy Beast. They were talking about how, it was Drinkbox. It was juice in there somewhere. And Drinkbox was talking about how if you can afford it, they recommend using a PR agency because they have much better press connections. And it's, again, a question of what you can afford, because even if it is worth it, I mean, that doesn't, just because you know it's worth it doesn't mean you have an extra, you know, $2,000 that you can spend on this or that improvement to your marketing strategy.
I am super risk adverse after being indie for 10 years and losing money after losing money on every game. So I don't go to the expensive. I haven't been going to the expensive shows. I have, I've yet to be willing. I'm almost willing to pay for PAX for the indie booth, but not quite. But what I have been doing is showing at local shows here in Seattle, the ones that, only cost $30, $50 to show your game at. And there is just a simple, you know what, I'm going to be there for a couple hours, or I'm going to be there all day. I'm going to probably sell this many copies. It's just sort of a clear win at that sort of price point and not having to travel.
And I would say in today's market, the trade shows have somewhat declined in value just because of how easy it's to communicate with people over the internet, putting out demos, the whole early access crowdfunding scene. I think it's been really huge in giving developers a chance to exhibit their games without having to be localized to these specific conventions.
Well, I think that's true, but I think you could also call that a double-edged sword, where in a more globalized market, in a more communicative market, in democratic kind of social media driven marketing situation, exhibiting is actually even more important because it lets you build personal relationships with fans. and it helps you stand out because you can also be, you can be working two fronts, right? As opposed to being limited to only one.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I want to touch on with the importance of exhibiting your game, and this was something that we were talking about before the cast, is with the choice to put your game into a bundle or not. This is a very interesting topic and one we could probably, you know, dedicate a whole cast to, but the bundling of games has become a very interesting tactic over the last 4 or 5 years, thanks to Humble Bundle, and just being able to sell your game for, like, a cent, but you're getting thousands upon thousands of people looking at it. Now, for the three of you, do you find that type of strategy beneficial, or do you think there are more cons than pros to it?
Humble Bundle, from what I hear, is pretty much a no-brainer. You're going to automatically make a lot of money if you're in the Humble Bundle. Any other bundle, not clear at all.
Okay.
Visibility is a really important factor in bundles, even the smaller ones. Just getting hands on your game tends to increase your sales in general. It's something that I've noticed from bundling multiple games of ours. Even though we haven't been incredibly active in that scenario, because I also feel like oftentimes if you bundle your game, the game loses the value to some extent. Mm-hmm. But the Humble Bundle is kind of an exception to that, because if you get in the main Humble Bundles, it's kind of almost like a seal of approval.
Okay.
But you do get your game distributed to lots of people. My only concern with bundles, actually, is that it sort of has twisted a lot of people's approach to video games and purchasing video games. And I'm just, my concern is that it's actually damaging indie game developers as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and we'll probably be talking about more about the indie developers in a few minutes. But to wrap things up, Tanya, what are your thoughts?
Well, we've been staying away from bundles. We've only released one game commercially so far. Shattered Planet came out on Steam less than a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping to get into a Humble Bundle, maybe. And other than that, we've been very skeptical just because we've heard about scams where people, I don't know, they buy your game for a cent and then they resell them, essentially like scalping concert tickets almost. And I don't really, I'm not that concerned, to disagree with Alex a little bit about people who buy bundles. I think it's okay if people can't afford to, or if they're very value driven, you know, they can wait for a bundle. I would be very concerned if people started bundling immediately after putting out their game, but I think they'll get negative press for that anyway, I hope. But I mean, if buying a game at, you know, around when it launches or at full price is kind of a premium experience for people who can afford it, I mean, maybe it's okay. Maybe I'm too forgiving of people spreading their money across more developers, but that's okay.
I agree with a lot of that. It's more that, just to kind of clarify what I meant, was that it's shifting into something where a lot of people are actually becoming game collectors and not game players. They've kind of inundated the scene to the point where everyone on Steam has at least like 30% of the games that they own, they have never opened.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's pretty strange.
Steam sales are a big part of that too. Like the Steam sale comes up, people buy the games and then never have the time to play them.
Yeah. You know, I actually know a guy who, he works in the games industry, and he decided he was going to play all of his games on Steam. He took like 5 months or something, but he decided he was going to play every single game for at least an hour. Because he'd gotten a bunch of these bundled things, and he said it was an interesting experience. I should have made him blog it.
I may just start doing that.
It would have taken 10 months.
I may just have to use that as an excuse to just go through my backlog and just live stream it every night. That'll probably be, it'll be a great filler for a lot of content. I have like 800 games, and who knows what's left to play on there.
Yeah, but the idea of having a backlog is something that is relatively new. And I'm not saying that it's bad. It's just shifting things.
Yeah.
And there have been games that have released on a Humble Bundle. There was a debut bundle for, what was it called? Vox, I think, and some other stuff. And so it's becoming this other thing. And I'm not like upset with it. I wonder where it's going, and it's kind of a concern, and it's something that I think all developers should kind of keep in mind when they decide to or not to bundle stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we'll talk more about the indie developer mindset in a few minutes. All right, so I think with what we just discussed, that sort of is a great lead into the next topic we have, and that is, where is indie going? Or where is, I guess, indie developers are moving to, or how they're going to have to change their development as the industry has been growing as a whole. And this is a topic that we can really approach from a lot of different directions. There's, of course, the mobile market push, casual games, and even AAA developers trying to downsize or try to compete with indies with smaller titles as opposed to, you know, $200, $300 million blockbusters. Now, I know Tanya and Jamie, you both worked at major studios before you opened your own. Alex, I'm sorry if I forgot this. Did you work at a major gaming studio before starting Robot Loves Kitty?
No, we're just self-taught noobs.
All right, so in that case, this first question then will be for both Tanya and Jamie. As developers who made the move from AAA to indie, what are your thoughts then on how game development has shifted for the two of you between that move?
You for first, me, Jamie.
for me, it is almost a completely different sport. Mm-hmm. Being part of a team, not having to worry about huge swaths of game development myself, doing not only, you know, the coding and finding the art and doing the business side and doing my own PR and marketing and that kind of thing. It's like when you're working for a company, you're sort of like, try to get as much resources as possible so you can make the game as good as possible. Mm-hmm. And now as an indie, it's like, I really need to keep, learn the hard way. Wow. I really need to keep my team lean and focused and pay rev share and keep the risks down and do my own PR and marketing it's been hard lessons.
Okay. Tanya?
I think it's been really interesting for me to work in a lot of different platforms. Like, I mean, there have been versions of this before. Like, there have mm-hmm. been big studios like EA, you know, trying to make mobile games or trying to make Facebook games or that kind of thing. They try to put together small teams to compete with other small, like, independent teams in order to capitalize on what they think is the most profitable. It's been an interesting line to walk with Kitfox because our first game, Shattered Planet, so we developed it as part of an incubator accelerator called Execution Labs. And their focus at that time, this was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, was mobile free-to-play. They believed, and their investors believed, that that was the place to be if you are a small team trying to make money in video games. And no amount of argument would change their minds. And we decided, you know, okay, well, they're the experts. We'll try it out. But we're also going to put it on Steam, just so you know. And they were like, okay. and so we did what we could within our comfort zones. We were not very comfortable with free-to-play single-player games, for sure. Mm-hmm. And we got an interesting mix of praise for how we handled non-aggressive free-to-play and Shattered Planet on mobile. But making the transition from that to then releasing it on Steam and being accused of being a mobile game, of being, mm-hmm. I don't know, a cash-greedy whatever, was really interesting because, yeah. I mean, I go on Reddit and I see that a lot of students or new indies are advised to start with mobile. And personally, I'm not sure that's the best option. But mm-hmm. I mean, telling someone to try to make their living on itch.io or to try Steam Greenlight without another source of fans is also pretty difficult. So mm-hmm. I think if I were to make a prediction about what's going to happen with indie the next few years, I mean, yeah, it's going to get harder for sure.
Yeah. And it's a really good point you made, Tanya, about the perception of mobile. This is something that we've been seeing a lot more of, if I would say, over the last year or two, with that perception that mobile games are looked down as the quote-unquote inferior to PC or console developer titles. And it's becoming a lot harder to make a quality mobile game, one that you could sell for $10, $15, because that market has been, you know, trained on 99-cent quick engagement titles. Now, what Alex said a few minutes ago regarding the bundling issue or devaluing your games, that's another major trend that developers have to look at and maybe keep an eye on when they're working on their title. So continuing with talking about the future of indie developers, for Alex and Jamie, what are your thoughts? Like, what are there any major trends you think we should be keeping an eye on over the next maybe 3-4 years?
Well, I have a non-answer, which is new markets appear out of nowhere, and some people are lucky enough to be the early adopters of that new market. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw this happen with the iPhone, we saw it happen with Steam, we saw it happen with Xbox Live Arcade, and we even saw it happen with Kickstarter. Like, Kickstarter was huge at first. These days, not pulling in the kind of money that it was before. I think of Kickstarter as a platform, just like, you know, any other platform. And so we're in, and we're in this sort of limbo right now where it's like, okay, Steam is cluttered, hard to make money on Steam. Mobile is super cluttered. Free to play is cluttered. It's like, the consoles downloadable, services are not doing the kinds of numbers that Xbox Live Arcade used to do. So we're just kind of, you know, I think in a holding pattern, waiting for a new platform to appear, a new awesome platform to appear, and the people who like are in the right place at the right time to jump on that platform will become the new success stories, and then a bunch of people will gold rush in after them, and indie will be sort of quote unquote revitalized at that point, I think.
Okay. And Alex?
I think what's the most interesting thing about the future of indie and where it's going is actually in the fact that it's getting easier and easier to make games. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I feel like that's actually part of what's influencing all these other things that have been mentioned, actually. Is that
absolutely.
There's Game Maker. There's tons of tutorials and all this. Unity, there's a free version of Unity. There's all of these ways to learn and to make on your own. And I feel like that is really impacting the indie scene and also affecting everything in a kind of a weird sort of trickle scenario.
It might create a situation where game making is like music making, where it's just something people do as a hobby and still awesome games get made. It's just that nobody really makes money doing it. They do it for respect and they still have day jobs.
Right. Yeah. Like, in a sense, right now we have the AAA studios that are kind of the quote unquote superstars. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else are just sort of releasing their albums for almost free, in a sense. But I think that with the way that AAA studios have started treating games with less respect, like releasing them when they were not really ready to ship and updating like day one patches and stuff like that. With that drop of quality, I actually feel like it's an interesting opportunity for indie devs to kind of switch and move up the ladder, so to speak, where quality indie titles can actually compete with these rock stars.
That's an interesting point, Alex, and one we've been starting to see like little inklings of that over the last year or two with early access, like games like Prison Architect, Kerbal Space Program. There is a recent game of Off-World Trading Company. These are games that are aiming for, you know, these big experiences that you can't get anywhere else. And that also raises an interesting question for the three of you. Do you think we will ever see a time where any developer could charge like $40, $50 for their game? Like, you know, we're getting up into the AAA or AA market pricing at that level.
I think some could already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've already seen that with Uber. They, you know, start out at this high price. So many people like invested in Planetary Annihilation and bought Planetary Annihilation when it went into early access on Steam, and it was at, you know, that really high price point. I forget exactly what it was, but
yeah, it was, I think it originally started like at $80, I think, when it first arrived on early access,
which is kind of ridiculous. Yeah. And amazing that people bought it at that. That's just an amazing sign of faith from fans, which is beautiful, I think.
Yeah. And Prison Architect started at, I think, 30 or 35 when it was first on, and they said they explicitly made it at that price to dissuade people from buying it now and just, you know, trying to play a completed game when it obviously wasn't.
And by contrast, I don't know if you noticed Wayward Souls. It's a mobile game, and it started out at $5, but with every single patch, he actually raised the price. Trying to encourage people to buy it now, while it was a good buy or something like that. It was an interesting experiment. I don't think he's released exactly what the numbers are on that.
That is really interesting, because there's this whole kind of, why would I buy this game on release? Because it's just going to get cheaper. And and that's something we're, in a sense, we're doing to ourselves. There's
and even
expectation.
Even if you didn't make put it on sale, you're still making it more valuable over time by adding more, you know, bug fixes, more content, expansions, and whatever.
Okay. Yeah. And Alex, what were your thoughts regarding whether or not an indie developer should or could be pricing their games at $40, $50?
I think it just depends on the game itself. Right now, there's so many different games that have hundreds of hours of gameplay that are just asking, you know, $5 or $10. Yeah. And that seems to be the norm at this point. It's a safe price point. Mm-hmm. And I think while some game devs could make that jump and be successful asking for more money, mm-hmm. I think being approachable and having a lower cost in general is probably the smarter route for most people's positions. Even as a AAA company, in a lot of ways, they would probably do better if they asked for less money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what we've been saying for years now, just to wrap this part up, is that the AAA developers have been charging, you know, $60 for a full game, and there is all this talk that once we were going to go digital, move away from printed copies, that game prices would go down. But people have been saying, you know, they want to raise the AAA price up to $70. And to me, that just sounds insane. I just don't think people are going to be willing to spend that much on one game when they have all these other alternatives at $5 to $10.
Well, but there's a little bit of a psychology of luxury products at that mm-hmm. point. Like, people are willing to pay extra if they think that it sets them apart, if they feel like it makes them a better person or a more high-class person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like in my experience, games on Steam that cost less than $10, with a very, very few exceptions, notably like Binding of Isaac, generally it seems like they actually do worse than games of a similar quality price at $10 or higher. And I don't think that's necessarily a luxury mindset, but it does seem like there's a few different arbitrary bars that gamers currently on Steam are expecting games to hit.
Okay. I think with that, we'll move on. Definitely a great topic, and these are all really amazing topics we had. We could really dedicate whole cast to, and maybe we'll revisit these, who knows, with a dedicated cast at some point. So let's move on. I'm sure this one's going to be a very lengthy topic. It is game development, art, or science. This is one that, wow, I know people have been having debates about for years, and whether or not, you know, there is a mechanical sense to making a game versus, you know, the art or the creativity. And this is one thing that we can see a lot of the pushes and pulls when you look at indie developers versus the AAA market. We've heard countless stories about AAA developers who are, you know, forced to, I guess, quote-unquote, appeal to the lowest common denominator with their games, you know, to try to get as many people into it. The whole rise of the quote-unquote dude bro culture, the Call of Duty's massive first-person shooters appeal. But then on the flip side, we have a lot of indie developers who are going for very quality, unique experiences. There are games like Gone Home and Dear Esther who really push the definition of what a game could be. So I guess to get this topic going for the three of you, what do you think about that question? Game development, art, or science?
I know that throughout most of my career, I've tended to approach it as a science. Because my parents were scientists and I was a psych major in college, so it's sort of like, and as sort of a staunch behaviorist also, so I sort of had this whole, like, you know, watch people play your game and learn from that and try to change the stimuli so you see more of the behaviors that you're looking for and fewer of the behaviors that you're not looking for, that kind of thing. That said, I think some of the most interesting things I've done have been times when I got away from that mindset and just had some sort of flashes of, I don't know where they came from, ideas that made experiences that were fun, just fun play experiences in their own right without worrying about, are people going to like this?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll go with Alex next.
I think there's no way, as a small company especially, to approach a game as purely one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
We've I probably have a very interesting perception of all of this because out of everybody here, I am in a lot of ways, I'm, like I said before, the noob. Calvin and I were both not educated to make video games. I'm technically a massage therapist and he's a college dropout. So we're very much just self-taught and kind of just flying by the seat of our pants in a lot of ways. That being said, we have definitely learned a lot through trial and error. And there are some things that there's definitely a scientific approach that you have to take. There's certain parts of being human that you can predict. Mm-hmm. At this point, it's pretty safe to say people who are playing certain types of games, like fighting games perhaps, or more action-based games, are probably not going to want to read. And mm-hmm. so having a tutorial where there's a lot of text that they have to go through is probably not the most efficient and might even turn them off. Mm-hmm. So there's approaches for that portion as well. But at the same time, Calvin and I are crazy risk takers and we do nutso things that just aren't things that normal people would try to do. And so far that's kind of worked out for us. With our next project, we'll see. But I think in general, it is just both. You have to be logical and scientific in your approach to various mechanics to some extent. And then you have to be artistic and creative in others. I know that sounds really general, but I feel like that's very much so the case.
All right.
No, I absolutely agree. I think that that you said it exactly right. I think in general, all games that you can generally think of are a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of the particular developer and the particular project, what the percentage split is for that particular game. I mean, at Kid Fox, we definitely approach it somewhere in the middle, and it depends. If we know it's a solved problem, if mm-hmm. we know that it's a mechanic that we can look to other games and see, and we have best practices to handle that particular mechanic and that that design for that feature, which is most of them, then we have our work cut out for us. We have a known quantity to solve. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the original idea of the game and what brings it its unique personality, its unique voice, and how its feeling comes around. A lot of that is art. I mean, you can make a painting like a scientist, and you can study bacteria like an artist, I suppose. But in the end, I think most games, it really depends on the part of the game you're working on and the process that you're particularly using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that middle approach is something that we see from a lot of developers. I would say a great example of that would be like Blizzard Studios, where the approaches that they put towards their games, they are probably one of the most analytical game developers around, with the stuff that they've done with StarCraft, Diablo, World of Warcraft. But then on the flip side, you have, you know, some of these amazing worlds that they built. World of Warcraft recently celebrated its 10-year anniversary last year, and it's amazing to see just how much people have grown to associate that game and that setting as its own unique world, its own unique art.
Yeah, I mean, I think people think of metrics and science and measuring players as something new because it became very talked about quite a bit in the last few years due to Facebook and mobile and that kind of uprising of the analytical systems developer mm-hmm. People. But I mean, it's been around for ages. I mean, Ultima was famous for using lots of metrics from its player behaviors and things like that. So it's really just about it doesn't necessarily limit you to think scientifically mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah. What are some games you think of as being sort of pure art? Like the first thing that would jump to my mind is actually Starseed Pilgrim. Mm-hmm. I remember playing that game and just being like, "What the heck is this? Like this game is like making me not it's almost as if it's trying to make me not want to play it."
Mm-hmm. Oh man, yet, I love Starseed Pilgrim.
there is something there, right? It hooks you in and it's got that something and
it's beautiful in its simplicity too.
Yeah. And that was actually going to lead into my next question for the three of you, is when you're looking at a game to play, do you prefer games that are like very highly mechanical, stuff like strategy games, tactical games, games that are really built around systems, or do you like games that offer the experience? As you just said, with like Star Sea Pilgrim, Gone Home, Analog, A Hate Story. These are games that are more about the story rather than about testing your gameplay skills or complicated mechanics.
Oh, you know, I would have said systems all the way, but then you said Analog, A Hate Story, and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, you're right.
I don't generally have enough time to dedicate to playing many games. Mm-hmm. So if it's the kind of game where I can pick it up and play it for like an hour and a half the most, and then put it back down again, then mm-hmm. I'm much more likely to give it a shot. But I'm a min-maxer by nature. I can't help it. So if there's a game where I can min-max, I will do it. I lost hours to Mini Metro. I don't know if any of you have seen
that. Yeah.
It's beautiful because it's just very simplistic. And you're just, you know, making subway lines and picking up squares and triangles and bringing them to their square places and triangle places.
Oh, that sounds really, that sounds like it will sink a lot of time for me if I would touch it.
It's beautiful. It's made by twin brothers who are in New Zealand, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That's another lovely thing about indies is a lot of the places have really awesome stories to go with them as the developers themselves,
mm-hmm.
which isn't something you get with AAA stuff. Yeah. I don't know. That's off topic, but I was just like, yeah, story.
Yeah, and to wrap this up, I think what you just said is a really good point about min-maxing or a game that can be played very quickly, but you can play a lot of it. I've been hooked on The Darkest Dungeon. It's a game that you can have a typical quest in 20, 30 minutes, but it's one that you can sit there for 3-4 hours doing these 20, 30 minute different sections.
20, 30 minutes is a bit long for me.
Yeah.
I have kids.
And that's the other factor. When you start having a family, it's also great to have games that are made around, like, a match only takes 5 to 10 minutes. And that could also be another good reason why casual mobile games have become so popular, is that you can get a quote-unquote complete experience in only 5-10 minutes, and then you can go get the bus or check on the kids or whatever.
Yeah, Clash of Clans is actually the only thing new I've played in the last couple months. And I'm still playing it. It's good. It takes a few minutes here, a few minutes there.
I definitely see, I don't know, I feel like it's my responsibility to play a lot of different kinds of games. And I mean, granted, I don't have kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's the games that I play because I feel like I need to, I don't know the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed playing Life is Strange recently, which I would describe as somewhere in between Heavy Rain and Gone Home.
Mm-hmm.
Much more like experiential. But I also spent like over an hour today playing Final Fantasy 14, and that was definitely not for any design learnings. That was just I wanted to.
You do have to kind of balance that. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes there's like research and there's things that you learn from playing other games. And as a game developer, I agree with Tanya. It's really important to kind of keep a kind of abreast of what's going on in the industry and what's coming out as far as new games are concerned and these new experiences. So I think it's valuable.
Yeah, really, I mean, it's not even just about as a designer. Like, now that I'm wearing all these different hats as an indie developer, like, seeing the fact that Darkest Dungeon chose to release on Early Access, I'm really intrigued by that. I intend to ask, I don't remember what his name is, but the Red Hook guy. I'm going to see him at GDC, and I'm definitely going to ask him what that's all about. Like, whether he's seen that there even was a difference. Before it came out, everybody was all anti-early access, and now it seems they did amazingly well, and maybe they'll even get another bump when they release fully on Steam. So I'm really interested.
Definitely. Okay, with that, let's move on. Our next topic is one comparing and looking at the various types of content that is now available for game development. We have designer-made content, procedural or random generated content, and of course, player-made content. And these are three very important yet varied philosophies for designs. We've seen amazing games make use of one of each of these. We've got games like designer-made, my brain is completely blanking. Oh, wait, here's one. We just talked about World of Warcraft would be an excellent example of designer-made content. Procedural random, we've got the numerous roguelikes, FTL, Spelunky, we just mentioned Darkest Dungeon a few minutes ago. And then player-made content, we've seen games like Kerbal Space Program, Team Fortress, and probably a lot more that I blanking on, of games that give the tools to the fans and then let them go nuts. And this can be a way of growing and sustaining a game for years to come. So my first question then for the three of you is, when it comes to these three different schools of philosophy, are there any that you prefer, or ones that you try to stay away from, or something completely different? And we'll start with Tanya this time.
So I've always loved MMOs as a player, and I can't really tell how much this is due to my own biases versus my professional design opinion, but mm-hmm. I am a big lover of player-made content. I'm not just talking about necessarily things like mods or even necessarily player structures like in Minecraft or Landmark or things like that. But just the fact that players themselves are a form of content, whether you're competing or cooperating, and I know that's a topic later, but I am enamored with social mechanics, and I feel like we're on the verge of a new revolution there, having played, you know, party games like Werewolf for years and mm-hmm. things like that. I'm really eager to see more kinds of player relationships being used as game content.
Okay.
And as a player and a designer.
All right. And Jamie, you're up next.
Well, I guess I'm a bit crazy because I do prefer procedural and fan-generated and player-generated stuff. And yet Energy Hook right now as it stands is sort of all us, like there's currently very little or no way that the fans and players can get involved and make stuff for it, other than emailing me and saying, hey, can I help mm-hmm. work on your game, which you know, I will probably start turning down at this point, but up till now I've never turned down. Mm-hmm. I really need to ship this game someday. and eventually I will make my stuff available and, you know, work through the Steam Workshop stuff and let people, you know, do their own things with my stuff. But yeah, it's like, it's weird. It's like, I have these preferences and I'm totally going the other way right now.
Okay. And last but not least, Alex?
I think all of them are awesome. And if there was a way to combine all of them together, it would actually be an amazing and kind of perfect experience in my mind. Designer-made content is wonderful because it's very hard to have an experience that is filled with discovery or just the storytelling of it is a little bit more challenging, and you can really do a lot more with designer-made content there. Mm-hmm. But procedural and random stuff is amazing. It's just, it adds so much mm-hmm. playtime and enjoyment, and there's a surprise element there as well because you never quite know what to expect. And player-made content can add things to the game that you could never have imagined as a developer, which mm-hmm. I just think is both a wonderful concept as well as something that can really help a game flourish.
Yeah, and definitely a good point regarding that with the player-made content, because as we just said a few minutes ago, Team Fortress has been going strong now for over 10 years. And over the last few years, they recently allowed people to submit content to the game, and by proxy, they can actually earn money off of any content that is accepted by Valve. And that's something that, even like right now, it seems such a weird idea that fans are actually able to get paid for their content. And I remember like 10, 15 years ago where mods were pretty much it. You could go to a site like FilePlan or whatever and get a mod for a game, and the person really had no other, you know, there's no income towards that. You were just making something that for a game that you loved, and, you know, if it gets featured, great. But today, it's like it can actually become almost like a business model for some people.
Well, at this point, or you could consider us game developers, as mm-hmm. fans who love Steam, who are making content for Steam and getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, with procedurally generated content, I think this is an interesting one. As we talked about with your game, Tanya, regarding both Moon Hunters and Shattered Planet, they were both procedurally generated designs. So
that's correct.
You had that sense of, there's that sense that some of it is designer made, that you as designer are setting the variables, you're setting the foundation, but then the game itself is designed to basically take that and run away with it. And for a lot of games, it can be a whole lot more work creating a good procedurally generated game versus one that it shows, you know, it's the same room, but maybe the table's on the right side instead of on the left.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, procedural content and designer-made content, I think, I mean, we're going to have both in all games, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's what I feel. I mean, yes, there is some appeal to linear, completely static experiences, but I mean, in general, I mean, there's just so many benefits to procedural generation. It's mm-hmm. hard to quantify how much it helps players to feel like their experience was unique.
Yeah. Now, here's another question for the three of you regarding player-made content. One of the more interesting requested features that I keep hearing fans say to their favorite games is Steam Workshop support. And for those of you listening who don't know what that is, Steam Workshop is basically Valve's way of having a centralized place for mods and all player-made content for games. Once it's been integrated into a title, players can submit content through the workshop, which other players can easily find, download, and update directly through Steam, as opposed to, you know, hunting for it over the wide world interweb like that. So, for the three of you, what are your thoughts on workshop functionality? Do you think that this is something that will become more and more important, or maybe even something required by game developers in the future?
I love it. I would absolutely be 100% about having more Steam Workshop things in all of Kid Fox's games. Mm-hmm. Our main problem right now is that Unity is not really set up to support that very well. You can do it. I'm not saying it's impossible. Games have done it. Mm-hmm. But we realized we were going to lose a lot of time if we tried to support Steam Workshop in any way other than being completely open source. Mm-hmm. So we've stepped back from that from Moon Hunters, but who knows, maybe Unity 6 will be different.
Okay. And Alex, your thoughts?
We were actually kind of in the same boat as far as that. We use Unity and we know that it's not an easy way to get new content. There's a wall there. but I think it's really interesting because there's this other way you could use it potentially. I'm not quite sure how that is, but I know places like games like Dota. Dota 2 has some sort of Steam Workshop thing where people submit their ideas and their art, and then it kind of goes through review and they get officially added into the game to some extent. Mm-hmm. At least that's my grasp of it from the outside. But I just wanted to also say that I feel like it's never going to be something that players feel is required, especially for all of the different types of games that are out there. While getting a new cart in Mario Kart might be an awesome addition, what could a player potentially add to, say, like Gone Home? There are some game experiences that I don't think lend themselves to player-made content, just like there are some games that don't lend themselves to procedural.
And I don't think that most players will ever really be that interested in it. I mean, when I think of casual players who want to generate content, it had better be part of the game like Minecraft. Otherwise, I mean, they're not going to go through the whole file nonsense of mm-hmm. Steam Workshop, no matter how easy it is to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Jamie?
I'm also using Unity. And I, at some point, I am willing to let a bunch of my code be out there in the wild. For people to do what they will with. I'm not sure. That won't be right at release, but at some point. And like I said, in a certain respect, I have fan-made content already, because sometimes people have heard about Energy Hook or played the alpha and said, hey, can I work on it? Can I make a level for it? Like, one of the best levels for Energy Hook is, you know, just somebody I met while I was giving a talk, and he said, hey, can I, you know, make a level for you? And I said, sure. And it's one of the best levels in the game. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, that is poor man's fan made content right there.
Okay.
Awesome. that reminded me that when we ran our Kickstarter for Legend of Dungeon, we had a few tiers where players could like create their own item for the game. And that drastically changed our approach to the entire game and actually ended up resulting in a much more lighthearted romp than we had originally intended. And so I felt like that was really awesome. But that also the idea of player-made content, what it does is it can shift the mood of an entire game. It can change everything about it, mm-hmm. which is something that I don't think all developers are going to be willing to do, because in a lot of ways, a video game, when you're a small indie studio, it's your baby, mm-hmm. and you don't want people putting weird makeup on your baby. But it also opens up the doors to all kinds of new experience, which is really cool.
Yep, definitely. Okay, I think we'll stop with that and move on to the next topic. Another amazing topic, and I really hate having to do so many topics, but it's really interesting to have this varied conversation. And I'm sure our next one's going to be another great example. And this is cooperative versus competitive play. And whether or not single players should be getting the shaft, or we should be caring more to multiplayer games these days compared to single player. And the argument, I think, for a lot of developers and publishers has been made in favor of multiplayer. There's so many cases and points. Hearthstone, League of Legends, Team Fortress, Call of Duty, and so on, are just so many great multiplayer games. And we talked about this, I think, earlier, where a good multiplayer game, even if it doesn't have player-made content but can be supported by players, can have such long legs in the market. I mentioned earlier in the cast, World of Warcraft is celebrating 10 years. I think Team Fortress 2 is getting up there as well. And the case is being made that maybe single-player games aren't as popular or don't have as much of a reach in the market these days as they were back in the 80s and 90s. So, for the group, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that single-player is still a viable market, or you think multiplayer is the preferable one for game developers?
Well, Jamie, you're making a single-player game, right?
I am.
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's such a thing as an unviable market. Like, mm-hmm. Energy Hook may not make as much money as a multiplayer game, but as long as I keep my costs down, mm-hmm. and then there is some point where I can afford to eat. so like we saw that with adventure games, right? Like, at some point, the big studios and the big game companies decided, you know, graphic adventure games were not worth making anymore. They were too expensive to make and didn't bring enough money back in. But indies were able to make cheaper adventure games, and there was still enough of a market for them that, you know, that people mm-hmm. the guys who do Gemini Rue and
Watch It Eye.
Yeah, them. Like mm-hmm. they could make a living. They could, you know, afford to eat on the money they were making.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Alex, what are your thoughts?
So far, every single one of the games that Calvin and I have been making have been cooperative. That's partially because we make the games that we want to play that don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so since we have very different taste in games in general, so we kind of squish them together and make a game we can play. But I feel like the validity of both types of gameplay are very much still present. I agree as far as like mm-hmm. it depends on your expectations and your intentions with the title. What we're doing now currently with Upsilon Circuit is something that's kind of taking the idea of cooperative gameplay to the extreme, because mm-hmm. We kind of have that Twitch Plays Pokemon style influence where there's actually an interface for everybody watching the people play to interact with the game, mm-hmm. because we find that fascinating. Whether or not that's actually a good business model, we have no idea yet. And I think, I don't know, single player games are really good for certain things. They're good for mm-hmm. telling a story in a specific type of way, like Gone Home would be a very different experience if it was multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. I feel like, I don't know, Legend of Dungeon was only local co-op, and we pretty much every day still get somebody asking us to make it online co-op. mm-hmm. So there's definitely a market for that. But I don't know, I think it's, as an indie dev, I feel like we have the freedom to decide what kind of games we want to make, and we get to also decide where success lies on that bar.
Okay. And lastly, Tanya?
Well, first I want to say I'm so excited about Epsilon Circuit. I'm really, everybody listening to this podcast should absolutely go look it up, because I'm really, really interested in what Robot Loves Kitty is doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that streaming games, there's definitely something there. That's part of what I was hinting at before about player-generated content, mm-hmm. with players themselves being interesting mechanics. But anyway, to answer the question, I absolutely agree that, I mean, players will always want single-player games. There will always be a market for single-player games. But as the lead of Kit Fox, I see single-player games as a risk. Mm-hmm. I think it's like any other risk. You have to take some risks, but I think it absolutely makes it more difficult or less probable for your game to have a potential wider reach, to have more word of mouth, and to have a longer shelf life than a game that is similarly entertaining but single player. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't make those. They absolutely always will. There will always be single player games. But I think if someone is trying to make, if they're trying to decide what kind of game to make, and all else is equal, I will pick multiplayer and specifically cooperative personally every single time. And the reason I'll pick cooperative over competitive is mostly because that space is much less explored. There have been fewer games that are interestingly cooperative than games that have been interestingly single player or competitive. So, and that's partially my personal taste. I mean, like Alex says, we're generally all making games that we wish existed. Mm-hmm. And that's the case for me too. And I'm fascinated by cooperative play. So yeah. That's where you'll see me for sure.
Mm-hmm. I had a maybe less than stellar experience making a cooperative game several years back, Schizoid for Xbox Live Arcade. It was all about the co-op, and it's the kind of co-op where like almost like playing bridge, where if your partner isn't that good, they sabotage the game for you as well. And it was very fun co-op if you had a good partner. But we also, you know, felt like, okay, this Xbox Live Arcade, people are going to, you know, buy this game. They're going to need somebody to play it with. And you kind of want to be friends with the person you're playing with. That's another kind of nice thing. Interesting thing about co-op. It's like, it kind of only like, it's better if it's with a friend. It didn't sell that well, and there was sort of a feeling that because I don't know, maybe it was just sort of a good idea at the wrong time. Like maybe it was too early for a pure co-op game, but
well, there were single player game modes though, right?
There were. They just weren't that good.
Oh, okay.
they were decidedly less fun than the co-op modes. So that was another problem. People would experience, you know, maybe that was part of the problem. People would experience the single player mode and think, this game's not, what's so great about this game? I don't, you know, hard to say.
Interesting.
And I think that's a really good point regarding sometimes the technical or the challenge of trying to create both a single and multiplayer experience in a single title. And there are some games that have tried to do both, and sometimes it ends up being less than each separate element. I would say a good example would be Payday or Payday 2. Now, despite having a single player option, you really can't get the experience unless you have three people playing. And I recently spoke with the developer behind Force, developer Beta Dwarf, and they talked about how the game was originally conceived to be strictly multiplayer and co-op focused, but then they felt in order to give the game a little bit more value, they had a single-player version of the campaign available, and the single-player version of the game just, it really doesn't work. The game is simply not designed to take a cooperative game and make it just one person. And I know when I spoke with you, Jamie, regarding Energy Hook, you talked about there's also the technical aspect of online multiplayer and the challenges of making sure the net code is stable, making sure people can connect right. And that's another wrinkle that can really sink a game, because if you make a poor multiplayer experience, it can really just doom your game's reputation. Then you have to basically build it back up and hopefully, you know, gain back those naysayers.
Oh, absolutely. We're terrified of our online multiplayer.
Now, another part of the single player versus multiplayer, I think, as you said, Tanya, regarding the risks of making a single player game today, we're seeing a lot of indie developers, a lot of games being kickstarted going for these massive single player type projects. I've seen games like Stonehearth, Of course, we mentioned Darkest Dungeon, and it seems like what we were saying a few minutes ago regarding that there will always be a fan base, no matter how small, there will still be people interested in it. So I think I do agree with the three of you that single-player content will still have viability throughout the years. It's not going to, you know, disappear one day. Now, in terms of multiplayer, when you guys think of a good multiplayer experience, or like what's something that you want to play with your friends or play with random people, are there any commonalities between games that you generally enjoy playing multiplayer that developers or enthusiasts listening could maybe take note of if they're ever thinking about making a co-op experience?
I gave a talk in 2000, I think it was 2012. Mm-hmm. About the many things that can go wrong with cooperative design. Because I'd been working in MMOs for a while at that point. And, I mean, there's, like Jamie mentioned, problems if both players have to be skilled, if one player can drag the other player down. Mm-hmm. There's problems. I mean, it's interesting to see how Journey solved a lot of cooperative design problems by reducing communication almost... like, no game has done since, until, like, Hearthstone, really, has tried to limit communication quite so severely to try to heighten the idea of players communicating ideas rather than words and insults.
Okay. Alex?
Partially because I've been doing research for Upsilon Circuit, I've been trying out MOBAs recently, which gave me a very interesting perception of the multiplayer experience, because it's both a cooperative and a competitive game. Mm-hmm. It's like this massive human experiment, I feel. I think that, I don't know. It's all cool. It's interesting to see how multiplayer games can fall apart when there is that disparity of skill. But it's also interesting to see games that kind of have ways of dealing with that kind of skill disparity, or it doesn't even matter how much you've played the game before you join in. There's not as many examples of that that I can think of right now. But, I don't know. For some reason...
MOBAs are a great example for, like, disparity of skill being a problem, like the getting blacklisted from Dota was such a thing.
Oh, I got horror stories of my friends getting a fight or playing League of Legends, and I was the cause of it because I sucked so much at the game that we lost, and then, oh my god, I don't want to revisit that memory.
One of the, this kind of actually goes back to something we previously talked about, which is inside of the, like, the science of game developing. Mm-hmm. There's these humans don't like losing. They don't like being responsible for losing. And what you will see happen as soon as a MOBA match starts to, it becomes obvious that your team is going to lose. Oftentimes, if you're playing with strangers, they will try to blame each other into oblivion. And I find that very fascinating. Just this concept that it's a cooperative game and it just falls apart. The whole team just starts hating each other because they're losing and they don't want to feel responsible.
Yeah. The clan mother of my Clash of Clans clan just messaged me saying a friend of hers got kicked from his clan. And Clash of Clans, like, pretty well designed as far as not letting, you know, a bad player bring down the rest of your team. So it's like, yeah, even that is a hard problem.
Yeah. It's amazing just how much, you know, hate and bile can be spewed out when you're playing a League of Legends or a competitive-minded co-op experience. I would say we can even see it to some sense in co-op, you know, player versus the AI games. You know, games like Payday 2, when you're trying to play with people and you're trying to complete a goal, and there's always that one person who's not following the group. And as we were just saying, when you play these multiplayer games, one person can really just screw up an entire experience. Or another problem is the more players that the game is designed for, the more time and energy must be spent to get that single experience going. When I was playing Left 4 Dead, it requires 8 players to have a complete experience. And finding 8 people on at the same time to, you know, dedicate an hour or two to one game is very difficult. I mean, with these podcasts, you know, it's going to be tricky getting 3 or 4 people on, but try getting 8 people to dedicate 2 hours to one game. It's just a nightmare.
But, like, I'm one of those people that is not particularly competitive, and that's just not something that I'm interested in as a player or a designer.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that I shouldn't, you know, keep an eye on that, and I shouldn't learn about how to make games that are competitive. But naturally, I tend to, away from that and towards more sociable, more cooperative, happy, nice, friendly games.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really interesting as a designer to recognize where you naturally tend to go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I imagine game design is like this big forest. And, like, some people are just drawn to certain paths through it, and they find different things, and it's all really interesting. But, like, I don't know if any of you guys have seen the Jason Vanderberg's 5 Domains of Play, where he adapts the big 5 psychological motivation theory to games, because Ubisoft has been funding, like, thousands of dollars of research. Have you guys seen that?
I haven't. I think I know the psychological aspects you're talking about. Is that like the Bartle test?
No. Okay. So the Bartle test was actually inspired by the Myers-Briggs personality type finder.
Okay.
The motivation theory is less about telling you what your type is, because it's not actually very useful. It's more about saying, what are you looking for? So what are you trying to accomplish? And you can have a combination of a bunch of different things at any given time, and different moods. You'll want to do different things, and that's why you play different games. But kind of recognizing this game is satisfying this motivation,
mm-hmm.
and seeing how a game that is equally, you know, well-regarded, equally popular, but satisfies a completely different, in fact, mutually exclusive motivation is actually really, really interesting. So I'm going to make sure that you post a link to that talk, because I found it really educational as a designer.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I'll make sure to include that in the roundtable notes, too. Okay.
Cool.
And I just remember one final question that I just want to ask the three of you. Oh, yeah. Here's my last question, then, regarding solo versus competitive play. I think this is a good one to end this topic on. What are your thoughts on games about the group contributing? Like, anything... I'm trying to think of examples. The only one that I can think of would be the game A Tale in the Desert. Have you all heard of that game before?
I played it for a little while back in the day.
Oh my god, I loved it.
Yep. Alex?
I haven't, but I know of it.
Okay. For those of you listening who haven't heard of it, A Tale in the Desert was a MMO-style game and was primarily built around crafting and player housing, player living in ancient Egypt. And part of the game was about this immense crafting system. Every object that could be made had, like, its own little mini-game. And players could, you know, team up, they could form guilds, or you can just have guys, you know, off on their own somewhere in the desert. And what made the game interesting was the social element of the game could be experienced by anyone, those who were just soloers or to the massive groups, and had to do with unlocking new technologies. Basically, everyone as a whole could donate their resources to specific researches, and once it would be finished, that technology or that upgrade would be unlocked for anyone playing the game. And I found it to be a really fascinating experience, because it was a single, it could be played single player, it could be played multiplayer, but it was one where everyone as a whole who was playing the game would be able to contribute and be rewarded by everyone else playing. And it's something that I would really hope be more adapted, less than, you know, pure competitive aspects or co-op or something like the League of Legends, you know, co-op group versus another co-op group. So for the three of you, what do you think about those types of, like, very social-minded games? I bet you, Tanya, I think you're going to probably enjoy that, because you've said you really do enjoy these social aspects behind these cooperative games.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tale in the Desert is a really interesting example of a place mm-hmm. where everyone's trying to do something. Like, it was almost more of a place than it was a game to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place I could go and a place I could explore. And I know everybody was trying to get thousands of people to work together to get a camel or whatever.
mm-hmm.
But really, it was just a place to go. And it was interesting because around that time, there was also Second Life was very big around
yeah.
then. I think there was There, which was trying to capitalize on Second Life and didn't make it. There were a few other knockoffs. And I don't know, I'm interested to see if we'll wrap back around to that as different gold rushers come in and try to make sense of what happened with Minecraft. Maybe we'll see more virtual worlds pop up that will remind me of 2003.
Okay. Alex, Jamie, any thoughts?
Well, that's kind of something we're actually doing with the Upsilon Circuit. What you described yeah. is part of what we're doing with the fan, sort of the quote-unquote audience, as we're calling them. There's going to be things where people have to kind of pool their resources for in order to make them an actuality in the game, mm-hmm. because I think that it's a fascinating concept. So that is, I feel like that's an amazing piece of cooperative gameplay. The idea that people can actually come together and make a permanent difference to something mm-hmm. is really cool. Of course, there's always room for trolls.
Yeah.
but that's also something that you can play into as well, I think. I think that I hope that that becomes something that kind of takes off and becomes a popular approach and exploration into that, because it's really interesting to me.
Okay. And Jimmy?
I think about Dark Souls and almost your sort of ability to leave tags that yeah. other players can see. Like, that's sort of a new kind of asynchronous multiplayer. Just dipping toes in the water, what you could sort of see and how players could become each other's content.
Yeah, and probably a question for another time, but I gotta mention here, I think it's really fascinating when you see games built around minimum interactions with the players. I know we brought up Journey a few minutes ago, and Dark Souls is another example of that, a game where players have such an immense effect on each other, but they can't really communicate with each other. I know we also mentioned Hearthstone as well, but I think that talking about it, we'll probably spend another 20 minutes on that topic alone. So with that said, we're going to move on to our final topic then for tonight, and this is one that I really wanted to save for last, so I think it's a great one to end this discussion on. And that is regarding, should game designers cater to the player's ego as much as we do in the industry? Now, this is a topic that we're seeing ripples of this in the mobile and casual markets, and even with major developers as well. When we talked about game development as an art versus a science, this is definitely more on the science side of things, either tweaking mechanics or experiences to get people more invested in your game or to even get them to spend money. The whole casual market, and what people have been complaining about for years, is how exploitive casual games can be in their mechanics and their presentations, you know, to trick people and say, oh, you only need to spend 5 cents, but then it's 5 cents every minute's worth of play. And we've seen people rack up, you know, hundreds of dollars of bills because of this. And the problem is, and this is something that I talked with a previous guest about, is that it works. It makes a lot of money. I mean, hell, Clash of Clans, Farmville, Candy Crush Saga, these games have made millions of dollars. I mean, they're some of the most successful games in the last 5 to 10 years. But the argument could be made, are they really games that we should be striving to make? Should they be examples that we should be following? So, to start this final topic then, for the three of you, what do you think about that? About this whole idea that should we or should we not care to basic human instinct?
One of the first game design, quote, principles, unquote, that a friend of mine told me was, it was sort of like, you gotta make the player feel like a hero. Like, that was sort of like, I don't know, 90s game design science right there. Was we'd had too many games where, or like arcade games up to a certain point were just like really difficult and really, really just sort of soul crushing, and you know, die on the first level with your first life. And I think through the 90s, we saw games getting easier and easier and handholding, and sort of instead of being games, almost they became, you know, amusement park rides.
And really good point with that. I mean, the whole power fantasy has become a real popular trope for the AAA market. We've seen, I can't even count how many games have been released making the player be the number one badass, you know, the guy who must save the world, get the girl, the whole deal. And then, as you said, Jamie, the theme park, the theme park, like, inspiration or philosophy has also been a major part of the casual games, or even some AAA games, where it's all about going through a very linear set of levels, you know, take 10 steps forward, this wall explodes every time, you know, you always have to go right here. And it's sort of where we're seeing that renaissance of the indie and early access or crowdfunding market is introducing a lot more games that have bite to them. We mentioned Darkest Dungeon, FTL, even Dark Souls is an example of that. Games which are not about holding the player's hand or making them feel, you know, oh, you're so strong, you're so powerful. It's more about you're going to get through this by the skin of your life. You know, you're going to be battered and bruised by the time you get through this dungeon.
I think I have an interesting thought as far as that goes, which is actually that all of those games that you just listed are still catering to the player's ego.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Darkest Dungeon, for example, if you lose, it's not your fault because the dungeon was random and you just had bad luck. And that caters to a player's ego.
Okay.
And things like that. Oh, it's just, you know, to give you an alternate perspective.
Yeah. And that's a really good point as well. Like I said, it's still catering to the player. It's not your fault. Like, there's very few games that will come out and say, you know, you fail. This is your fault. You know, how dare you? You know, stop playing this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think if anything, Dark Souls and FTL and roguelikes in general, I mean, as someone who's made a roguelike, I'm not accusing anybody, but they are almost an arms race of ego with the player in that. Mm-hmm. It's more subtle, but the end goal is still to help the player feel that they are the ultimate master. That is still the fantasy going on for sure.
Okay. And, well, going back to the original question regarding caring to the egos and whether or not we should be doing that, Alex, what are your thoughts on that?
So, I'm desperately trying not to, like, promote the game that I'm working on, but it's... Upsilon Circuit.
Go ahead and promote your game.
It's soul-crushing! It is designed to make you sad when you lose, because the general idea of it, and the reason I wasn't describing it when I introduced myself, is that it's kind of a long spiel, but I'll try to keep it really short, which is that... When you play, there's only a few hour window where it's actually a playable game, and there's only 8 slots in the entire world that are playable. And so if you get picked to play, you kind of are in this luxurious position of being a chosen one. But then when you die, you never get to play the game again. It's actual permanent death. And that's one of the main focuses of it, because we were... The last game we made was a roguelike, and I was looking at it and thinking about it, and I love Legend of Dungeon, but it doesn't actually give you the kind of consequences that I kind of wanted people to have. You die in your dungeon, you lose your stuff. It's a bummer, but it wasn't really your fault. Oh, well, I'll play again. You know, it was bad luck. I'll play again. It's the whole ego thing. And I feel like if you play Upsilon Circuit and you're good at it and you don't die, you deserve every piece of ego that you have. Like, it is about your ego, but it's not catering to it. It's embodying it, I think.
Okay. And last but not least, Tanya?
I change my mind every day on this. I'm the one who suggested this topic, and I'm not really sure how I'd answer it, honestly. Today, I feel like I don't mind. Today, I feel like people will always gravitate to the media that they feel most comfortable with. Some people feel comfortable being challenged. Some people feel comfortable being praised. And whether it's reading a book that makes you feel smarter and more educated, or whether it's watching a TV show that makes you feel better about your life because the person on the screen is miserable, or whatever it is, there'll always be a role for entertainment as whatever emotional need you have. So I think that there is, of course, a danger when there's a mismatch between what you're trying to accomplish with your game and people playing your game who don't need the experience you're trying to give them, for sure. It's almost a marketing and design mismatch at that point. But overall, I don't think there's anything inherently harmful about power fantasies. I'm primarily a bit concerned when almost all games ever made are all power fantasies. I feel like there is definitely room for growth and room for finding new audiences. And mm-hmm. it's just a matter of taking that risk and being able to hedge a little bit on the edge of the ego machine that we're building.
Okay. Now
they're weird like that. So yeah. In a sense, like everything any of us does is centered around selfishness.
Yeah.
There's lots of eyes in our universe. Mm-hmm. So I agree with a lot of what you just said, Tanya. I mean, even though I'm making a horrible, mean game.
Well, I'm hoping when I see you at GDC or PAX or wherever, I can convince you to not to let me play twice. Just twice.
Maybe. We'll see.
Wait, if she gets a second try, I need to get a second try. I may need a third or fourth try with my luck. Okay, now another part of this that I want to go back to, and definitely a major part of this topic, is regarding the social game or the casual game use of this, and as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the exploitive nature of this. We see, you know, there's so many horror stories of people playing, you know, Farmville, and they're spending hundreds of dollars on this, or a kid who downloads a mobile game racks up like a $500 bill in the game. And as I said, these tactics, while a lot of people complain about them, they really do work. I mean, these are proof positive examples that, you know, caring to the ego or caring towards, you know, keep going, my lord, you know, the whole Ebony type thing, that these are powerful and effective marketing tactics. But for the three of you, do you think that these are things that we should be exploring? Should we try and make more games like Farmville or like Candy Crush Saga or et cetera, et cetera?
I think that there should be heavier regulation on economic manipulation. I think there's a reason why we have lots of laws governing what used to be called gaming, which is gambling, which a lot of these games should probably be considered as a variant of.
I think exploitation on any level is inappropriate in a video game. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the free-to-play approach to making money is inappropriate. I think there's ways of doing that that have proven to be successful, like even like Dota or League of Legends types of scenarios where you get access to most of the content and then there's additional free things that don't even break the balance of the game. I feel like that's 100% acceptable. But playing on people's ego or weaknesses or just charging them to make something actually happen in the game is exploitation, which I don't think makes it a game anymore, almost.
Well, but, I mean, to play devil's advocate a little bit, I mean, I feel like a lot of marketing campaigns for $60 games are absolutely the same thing, that they're emotionally manipulating you into feeling like that this thing that you're going to buy is going to make you powerful and more capable and a better person and smarter and whatever. So you better lay down your $60 pre-order. And that manipulation isn't necessarily any more or less ethical, especially when they don't match up to the actual product they're selling.
I agree. Actually, I definitely agree with that point as well. It's not just something that happens with free-to-play games. There's
Alex, money I'm trying to fight with you. You never fight with me.
Oh, sorry. You're wrong. You're wrong and you're a bad person. I win.
Yay.
We argued.
And it, as you said, Alex, it's really hard to, like, when you're trying to exploit the player, like, there is that some sense that you do need to do that, or we see it being a popular thing. The AAA market is a really good example. I mean, we see commercials every day for games that are, you know, built towards that power fantasy. I mentioned earlier, like, the dude bro culture. A good example would be like Bioshock Infinite and how they try to make the advertising, make the marketing bill around this being this, you know, first-person super gory shooter when the game was designed to be more about, you know, the philosophical sides of this crashing utopia.
Oh, yeah. I think one of the challenges is that marketing is an incredibly difficult thing in general. It's something that I struggle with, I know. Because for me personally, at least, I like being humble. It's the kind of persona that I am comfortable with. But to market your game, you kind of have to go out there being, I'm awesome. This thing I made is awesome. You should look at it. You're going to love it. And if you don't do that, if you're just like, hey, I made this thing. I like it. If you want, you can check it out. It doesn't inspire curiosity. And I think in a lot of ways, the commercials that AAA studios are putting out, which sometimes their marketing budget is as big as their development budget, if not bigger at this point. I don't quite know. I don't keep up with those numbers, but I know that they put a lot of money into marketing. Mm-hmm. It's bound to get inflated. It's going to be shouting about its awesomeness on a level that there's no way the game could live up to that on some level. You're almost always disappointed with a movie, so to speak, like as an example, a movie after you've seen the trailer.
I refuse to watch trailers.
It just sets you up for having seen all of the awesome moments in that 1 minute, and then you get all the filler, and that's what you pay for, which is strange. Mm-hmm. But it's in every industry is what I was trying to kind of point out. It's not just games. It's just humanity. And it goes right back to the ego thing, even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And Jamie, what are your thoughts on the social, on whether or not we should be using these exploitive tactics in games or not?
I think Clash of Clans is on the side of the angels.
Whoa!
I'm just saying that I've been playing it, and my daughter's been playing it, and we're not tempted to go spend extra money on it so far. In fact, if you spend money on it, you're just going to get matched with tougher clans. So there's an argument to be made for not spending money on it. I don't know. That's been my experience. I don't feel like I'm being manipulated into spending money on it.
Okay. And I think with that brings me to, I guess, one of my two final questions then for this topic. Oop, I'm hearing the breathing again there, Jamie, a little bit.
Oh, sorry. It's also the first free to play game I've ever stuck with, or like I've tried a couple and played them for an hour or whatever, but this is the first one that's like, oh yeah, I want to keep playing this.
Okay. All right. So here's one of the two final questions, and for the three of you, regarding the exploitive tactics, I guess this is Jamie sort of answers with Clash of Clans, but as we said, that there is a use for them. We need to, puff up the game. We need to get people into them. But for the three of you, what are some examples of games or marketing campaigns that made use of these tactics that you found for whatever reason acceptable or even got you to purchase or play this product?
Oh, no, what's the name of it? I have to grab my tablet. Well, MOBAs, like I mentioned, Dota is something that does that, as well as League of Legends. I appreciate free-to-play games that offer additional content as opposed to restricting content. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a really nice approach. Plague Incorporated, that's the one. I generally, I spend zero money on apps. But I played so much of the free version of Plague Incorporated because I had fun naming the diseases ridiculous things like logging. But I decided that I wanted to actually support the developer and give them some money, because that's another element of it as well, is that when you get a free-to-play game, in a sense, you get to have a demo and then decide if you want to make a purchase or not, which I appreciate just as an individual.
All right. And Jamie, are you still going to go with Clash of Clans, or are there any other examples?
I'm pretty good friends with Richard Garfield, so I'm pretty fond of Magic the Gathering.
Okay. And
I'm jealous. That's cool.
All right. And Tanya?
I actually recently picked up Bonza, which is free to play. And like Alex said, it kind of serves as a demo. And if you like it, then you spend a buck and you get a bunch of puzzles. It's a crossword puzzle style game. Mm-hmm. It's actually a new form of game where you're forming the words. It's somewhere in between a crossword and a scramble, basically.
Okay.
And so for $1, I'll get 30 new puzzles. And it feels like I'm just buying a booklet, essentially, maybe my mom would have 30 years ago.
Right.
So that doesn't feel exploitive at all. It feels very natural.
Cool. All right, here's my final question for the three of you, and this will sort of wrap up this topic, I guess, and maybe wrap up the cast in general. And as we said, regarding these exploitive tactics and how they found themselves so prevalent prevalent among the mobile and casual game markets. One thing that we've been talking about, I've had several discussions with previous podcast guests on, is whether or not the casual games market, because of their use of these exploitive tactics and trying to get quick engagement, is heading for a bust or not. And a lot of people are saying that it may be, just due to the fact that these very exploitive tactics don't promote sustainable or long-term growth. So my final question then for each of you is, do you think the casual games market, as it stands right now, is sustainable, or do you think that there are signs that it may be busting soon?
I think that the main problem with mobile games specifically isn't actually anything to do with the markets in terms of mechanics or the audience necessarily changing or being tired of it. I mean, like Jamie said, there's a solid appeal to games like Clash of Clans. The main problem is discoverability, with so many great developers being able to make so many games, like Alex pointed out earlier. And I think that, Clash of Clans is making more money now than it ever did, and it's been there for 3 years, and it's been at the top of the charts for 3 years. And that kind of stability is no longer stability, it's stagnancy. And so if anything's going to bust, I hope it's that stagnancy, personally. I'm always interested in disruption.
Okay. And Alex?
I completely agree with Tanya on this point. But I also, my one tidbit of a thought would be that I believe just the other day, Apple released a pay once and play category, which very much lends itself to this kind of topic, because it's showing that they're kind of been this acknowledging factor. Like, it's all right, we get it, you don't just want to have this free to play stuff, here's the other side of it, we know that this is important too. So I feel like things may shift a little bit in that direction of at least adding the discoverability of those types of games.
Okay. And last but not least, Jamie.
Yeah, it's hard for me to I have trouble believing that just a monetization model is bad in itself. But that's awesome about the new Apple thing. I hadn't heard about that. That might be a new market opening up that people who are in the right place right now can just sort of, you know, seize on.
Okay. All right. So I think with that, this is a good point to end the roundtable on. We've had very fascinating discussions, and I love to talk with each of you more about these in the future, because I mean, we could really spend, you know, 30 minutes, an hour or two on each one of them. So they've all been great topics, and I'd like to thank all three of you for pitching them for the roundtable. So with that, to wrap up the roundtable, I'm going to give each one of our panelists just a 30 seconds to a minute of final thoughts, or whatever they would like to say about either the industry, these topics, or whatever. So we'll start with Tanya.
I just want everybody listening to know that I think, even if you're going to be my competition, I really, really hope that you try your hand at making games. I think in high school, we all write poetry and we all try our hand at drawing, and even most of us try making a video here and there. I think it's important that if you're interested in games, that you try it just once. Just try it just to see what it feels like to make a game. You can go, you can find the tools, you can do it no matter what your background is. You don't need to know how to program. And you can express something about yourself and about your human experience. And if you ever want someone to see it and give you some opinions, then feel free to look me up on Twitter. I'm Tanya Short, and my Twitter is Tanya X Short. And I hope I hear from you and about your game soon.
Awesome. All right, Jamie, you're next.
Yeah, I don't really have nothing, but what Tanya said was beautiful.
Yep, definitely.
Aw, thanks.
Yeah, great words. Thank you, Tanya. And last but not least, Alex.
I definitely think what Tanya said is beautiful, too. That was awesome. I will also put my Twitter out there, because I actually am just beginning to learn how to program. I'm generally on the art and design side, and so I have extra interest in seeing the games that people make that are new to making them. My Twitter is at Robot Loves Kitty, and that'll reach both Calvin and I. But aside from that, the only other thing I would say is that this was just the opinions of three game devs, not necessarily the all-encompassing perceptions and opinions of the industry as a whole. And it's okay if you have disagreements with them or more questions. And that's another thing that you can tweet, which is questions about our opinions, I think.
Yep. Definitely great words by everyone. I think Tanya won the final round with her little speech there.
No!
I'm the champion! Yep,
you win. And so your prize is you get a second life in Upsilon Circuit. That's the
rule. Yay!
All right. So,
or did we just cater to your power fantasy?
Yep, I think we just did. All right. So with that, we will be wrapping things up. So again, Tanya, Alex, Jamie, it was a pleasure talking to you tonight. And thank you for participating in this second roundtable.
Thanks, Josh.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yep, not a problem. So for those of you listening, thanks for tuning in to the second roundtable here at Game Wisdom. If you have any comments about the format or suggestions, or even maybe developers to ask, feel free to leave them in the comments below. For any developers listening who would like to participate in a future roundtable, feel free to shoot me an email. You can find me at josh@game-wisdom.com. That's also found on our Submissions Wanted page on the site. And as always, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, you can send us ideas for topics or be future podcasts also under Submissions Wanted. And we are, of course, still running our Patreon campaign to help secure monthly funding for the site. So make sure to check that out. That is also on the front page. And with that, we're going to say goodbye. So thank you for tuning in. Chances are the next roundtable may be in either March or April. So be sure to look forward to that. Have a great rest of the week, and we'll talk to you next time. Take care, everybody.